Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kadhim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: قيل للقمان: ما يجمع من حكمتك؟ قال: لا أسأل عما كفيته، ولا أتكلف ما لا يعنيني.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, Luqman was asked, What is the crux of your wisdom? He replied, I do not ask about that which I know already, and I do not burden myself with that which does not concern me.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When talking about the beautiful dialogues of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that this divinely appointed Imam spoke about how we need to organize our time. And when we organize our time, we are able to organize the affairs of our life, and we are able to educate our souls. In one of these conversations that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam had with his companions had asked them on how we should organize our time. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam responded and advised his companions by saying, Try hard that your time may be divided into 4 hours. Now here, just as a little side note, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam is talking about 4 parts of one's life when he is referring to hours. And then the divinely appointed Imam says, 1 hour is for supplicating to Allah, the Almighty. 1 hour is for the affairs of one's livelihood, meaning going to work or having a job and earning our livelihood. 1 hour is for associating with our brothers, our friends, and the reliable people who let us know our defects and are inwardly loyal to us. And finally, the 4th hour is that we should be alone with ourselves and, of course, not indulge in non-forbidden and haram things while we are in that seclusion and in that isolation. Now, a very beautiful conversation here, and very beautifully Imam al-Kadhim explained these 4 parts that one should split up their life into, or their daily life into. 1 part is for the supplication to Allah, whether it's our prayers, wajibat, obligatory prayers, our supplications, our du'as, our litanies, different things such as those, a recitation of the Holy Quran. And again, 1 hour or 1 part, which is for seeking our livelihood, whether it's going to work or in certain situations going to school. Another hour is to be able to hang out with friends, spend time with good friends. And it doesn't say any kind of friends. It is friends that let us know our defects and friends who are inwardly loyal to us. And finally, the last hour in which we are alone and we get a chance to reflect and contemplate upon our lives, our future, our past, our present, etc. And again, beautiful things put forth in this conversation by the infallible Imam. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imama of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. The objective of it was to overthrow the regime. Now, before the Abbasids, it was the Umayyads. But it doesn't matter who is there, as long as it's not the government of the Ahlul Bayt, the government of God's laws, and it must be removed. The movement of the Ahlul Bayt continues. To keep this movement alive, not just keep Shias believing in the Ahlul Bayt, believing that we need to go to the Ahlul Bayt as teachers and learn our ahkam. When we want to go to Hajj, we learn the ahkam of Hajj from Imam al-Kadhim. Not that. That was not perhaps very difficult. If it was limited to that, there were various schools of thoughts and various ideologies that were around, and leaders of those ideologies, those schools of thought, were able to teach and promote their views. There wasn't much resistance against them, unless they had a political agenda, which the Ahlul Bayt clearly did, salamullah alayhim ajma'in.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Reading out the names of fallen British soldiers in Iraq while a man responsible for their deaths and millions more is honored. Only meters away, a protest organized by Stop the War Coalition calling for former Prime Minister Tony Blair's knighthood ceremony to stop.
It's an absolute outrage that someone who lied to the people, lied to Parliament, lied to the Cabinet, took us into an illegal war which led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and destroyed a country should be given a knighthood. I mean, it's a disgrace.
The biggest of those lies in the so-called Iraq War dossier, a claim that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed mass murder weapons.
We knew
in September 2002 that the dossier amounted to nothing. We were told it proved there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody serious who looked at that said it didn't prove anything of the sort. Blair was determined to go to war regardless. He was determined whatever the evidence said. So essentially they cooked up the evidence.
In 2016, all the lies were exposed by the so-called Chilcot Report that concluded Iraq posed no immediate threat at the time of the 2003 invasion. For Tony Blair, though, who defended his decision to go to war, that has not meant a war crimes tribunal, but the UK's most prestigious knighthood. To anti-war activists, that is a dangerous precedent.
Well, it's trying to make it easier to go to war in future. It's trying to say to politicians, even if you go to war and it's illegal, it's criminal, it's based on lies, it has nothing but devastating impact, you can still be honoured, it'll be forgive and forget.
But forgive and forget they have not. Tony Blair continues to be one of the most detested politicians at home and abroad.
Nearly two decades since the Iraq War, Tony Blair is known by tens of millions here and abroad as a war criminal, despite efforts to reinvent himself as a visionary leader, which is why these protesters say the only court Tony Blair should be attending today is not a royal one. Saeed Burza, London.
As people in Afghanistan are facing acute hunger, poverty, and deprivation, Kelly Clements, the Deputy High Commissioner for UN Refugee Agency, and her delegation visited Kabul to address the humanitarian situation.
This is a very important moment for this country and the people of Afghanistan. It is a time where the world's attention has turned to other situations of displacement, other war, other conflicts. But the needs of the Afghan people are incredibly important, and it's one of the reasons why I have come here now to this country to see how we can best support the needs of the Afghan people.
The UNHCR commissioner also stressed the need for providing a safe ground in Afghanistan for Afghan refugees who want to return to their country and for the people to enjoy their rights.
In addition to the 3.5 million internally displaced people, women, children, and men. There are 6 million Afghans outside of Afghanistan that want to see a country at peace, that want to see a country that is stable, that is inclusive, and that looks after the needs of its people.
Meanwhile, the Taliban's acting Minister for Refugees Affairs welcomed the delegation and said that Afghanistan is ready to cooperate with the UN bodies and other charities to assist the Afghan people.
We appreciate the UNHCR's work and programs in Afghanistan. We expect the international community and the UN to separate the humanitarian issues from political ones and continue their life-saving assistance to our country. We are fully ready to cooperate with them in all of their projects across the country.
In Afghanistan, war has subsided. But the impacts of drought, sanctions, and cuts in global aid continue to drive people from their homelands to other provinces and countries. The UN officials' visit to Afghanistan comes as the country faces widespread hunger and displacement. Afghans are calling for solidarity and funding from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The day before France votes in their first-round legislative elections, rallies were held around the country with two objectives. First, the far right is expected to win their greatest number of seats in 36 years, but that still only means less than 5% of the National Assembly. Second, the biggest question is, will President Emmanuel Macron retain his absolute majority and thus the ability to ram through more austerity-minded legislation? The left and Greens have surprisingly united, and the polls say Macron's coalition might get upset.
This government is not for the French people and for France, but is instead for the destruction of France. And look at the shameful police brutality at the recent Champions League final. That's what Yellow Vests have been enduring since November 17, 2018. And this government has just gotten worse and worse.
The Yellow Vests were a social revolt based around economic issues, and their list of demands are more relevant than ever. Lack of public services, low wages, high taxes, frozen pensions, and the increasing cost of the most essential goods are now major problems across the West. However, despite being the most popular social movement in recent French history, they aren't going to make major political inroads into Parliament this election. Even if Macron's coalition doesn't win an outright absolute majority, their right-wing economic philosophy is certain to find support among the mainstream conservative party. They may dwindle to just 10% of seats, but that would be enough to keep Parliament controlled by right-wing ideology. As first-round votes are often used for so-called protest votes, the results could be deceiving. The only certainty seems to be that Macronism has lost much of its appeal and momentum since 2017. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Sunday, some 9 million Italians were called to elect mayors and councillors in 971 towns and cities in a vote in which the strength of mainstream political parties has been put to the test before national elections next year. Elections were held in big cities such as Genoa, Verona and Palermo and in hundreds of provincial capitals. The turnout was lower than 50% in most municipalities, as disaffection with political actors and institutions continues to be on the rise. On Sunday, Italians were also called to vote on 5 referenda regarding justice issues. The referenda failed because they did not achieve the required quorum of 50% of voters, a further sign of electors' disenchantment with the country's politics.
The doors of the halls of power have been closed and the people got left out. I cast my ballot today simply to preserve my right to vote. The government should have not held a referendum on such technical justice matters. It's been just a waste of public resources.
Far-right party Brothers of Italy is likely to win the highest number of votes according to polls. The Brothers of Italy was the only party that stayed out of Mario Draghi's government. Nevertheless, the ideological distance between its leader, Giorgia Meloni, and Prime Minister Draghi is narrow. Meloni, a staunch NATO advocate, is supportive of Italy sending arms to Ukraine and of increased spending on defense.
Polling stations have been deserted by voters, not only because of disaffection with politics, but also because the Italian media barely talked about this referenda and local elections. Their focus is the war in Ukraine only. We are sick and tired of politicians' empty promises.
Since the start of the Ukraine conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown over half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and want the government to work for a peace proposal. Their calls have so far gone utterly unheard. Max Civili, Rome.
Venezuela is one of the farthest countries from Iran, but it's among the closest allies. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has had a busy schedule since he arrived in Iran on Friday. Here, he took a tour of one of Iran's major engineering companies, Mapna Group, where he was warmly welcomed by the Iranian tech firm.
It's a pleasure to have the Honorable Venezuelan President, Mr. Nicolas Maduro, at our company to present some of our capabilities, products, achievements, and our future plans to His Excellency.
Maduro has been in Tehran as part of an official trip that was slated to take 2 days, but later was announced to last for 4 days. Heading a politico-economic delegation, the Venezuelan official and his Iranian counterpart, Ibrahim Raisi, signed a 20-year cooperation agreement on Saturday to expand ties in the oil and petrochemical industries, military and economy.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice and that we will stand up to imperialism.
será un mundo de justicia sin imperialismo.
Iran has been a key player in supplying fuel to energy-hungry Venezuela. Both sanctioned by the United States, Tehran and Caracas has boosted their partnership since 2020, especially in energy projects and oil swaps, helping the South American nation mitigate the impacts of Washington's embargoes. During Maduro's visit, the two sides also agreed to launch direct flights between Caracas and Tehran in order to promote tourism and trade between the two countries.
With shared concerns, shared interests, and a common rival, Tehran and Caracas are poised to push the envelope on their strategic alliance, viewing it as a counterforce to what they call Washington's coercive measures against both nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thousands of South Koreans gathered in downtown Seoul to remember the tragic deaths of Shin Mi-sun and Shin Hyo-soon, ran over by a U.S. military vehicle on their way to their friend's birthday party on June 13, 2002. The children's family's lawyer hopes for change in U.S. relations and influence on Korea.
The massacre of two middle school students is a symbol of unequal South Korea-U.S. relations. In that regard, I think that the work of candlelight among our people to establish an equal relationship between South Korea and the United States in the future and move toward peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula remains unfinished.
Two U.S. soldiers were charged with negligent homicide, but acquitted in a U.S. military court amid anti-American candlelight protests. The deaths of Mi-sun and Hyo-soon under the tracks of a U.S. military vehicle 20 years ago are but one episode of a problematic alliance relationship, from the Status of Forces Agreement to the cost of hosting 28,500 troops in South Korea. Alliance ties are a constant source of controversy and debate. Some argue South Koreans view the presence of U.S. forces as an obstacle preventing the country from exercising sovereignty.
It's not fit for the global era and very risky for South Korea to cling to a falling sun with the status of American hegemony declining so much. I hope we can establish more neutral diplomacy reflecting our national interests.
New President Yoon Suk-yeol seeks to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, a shift in policy that worries many South Koreans. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his visiting Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro have signed a 20-year document on comprehensive strategic cooperation, which mainly covers a wide range of areas, including petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural, and political fields. In a press briefing after the signing ceremony, President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Earlier on Friday, in an interview with Iran's Spanish TV channel Hispan TV, Maduro said Venezuela and Iran are on the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people. Heading a high-ranking political-economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago. Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Saman Kujrip, Tehran.
In the most
Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets, saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation, but this time it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by a quarter of 1% next month, most likely a half of 1% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I have had also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO. ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The European Union is poised to launch legal action against Britain after British ministers controversially claimed an emergency loophole allowed them to scrap post-Brexit checks and standards in Northern Ireland. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Rowena Mason and Daniel Buffy. The piece is titled EU Poised to Take Legal Action Against UK Over Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. The European Union is poised to launch legal action against Britain after British ministers controversially claimed an emergency loophole allowed them to scrap post-Brexit checks and standards in Northern Ireland. In a surprising admission, the British government accepted that its new Northern Ireland Protocol Bill would mean it did not meet its obligations under international law. It justified the move under a principle called the Doctrine of Necessity, claiming the protocol was causing peril to society and politics in Northern Ireland because of the threat to the Good Friday Agreement. Prime Minister Boris Johnson insisted the changes in the legislation were relatively trivial measures designed to ease trade disruption between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, as the bill was published on Monday, 13th of June. But the European Union said it would launch legal action for infringing the Northern Ireland Protocol, and a majority of members of the Northern Ireland Assembly accused Boris Johnson of being the reckless one by destabilising the Good Friday Agreement. Under the new legislation, which is likely to face considerable opposition in Parliament, the government would scrap checks for firms selling goods from Great Britain destined for Northern Ireland, rather than the European Union. Instead, the government envisages the creation of a green lane of fewer checks for those selling goods heading for Northern Ireland, and also a red lane for existing checks for goods destined for European Union countries. It would also allow firms in Great Britain to export to Northern Ireland to choose between meeting EU or UK standards on regulation, which are expected to increasingly diverge. Further measures include bringing Northern Ireland's tax break and spending policies into line with the rest of the United Kingdom, and changing oversight of trade disputes so that they are resolved by independent arbitration rather than the European Court of Justice, a clause pushed by conservative Eurosceptics. Maroš Šefčovič, the European Union's Brexit Commissioner, hit out at damaging move by Britain and threatened to take British ministers to court. He said, as the first step, the Commission will consider continuing the infringement procedure launched against the UK government in March of 2021. We had put this legal action on hold in September of 2021 in the spirit of constructive cooperation to create a space to look for joint solutions. Britain's unilateral action goes directly against that spirit. The European Union will on Wednesday restart legal action against the United Kingdom for the government's failure to carry out checks on agri-foods and launch two new infringement proceedings for not establishing order posts and sharing data with the European Commission. Speaking after the bill was published, Thomas Byrne, Ireland's Minister for European Affairs, told LBC that there undoubtedly will be consequences for Britain. If you run through a traffic light, you'll be punished. If you commit some other breach of law, you'll be punished, he said. There will be consequences for Britain, but we don't want to get into that space. We want this to be worked out between the two sides for the betterment of Northern Ireland. Meanwhile, Annalena Baerbock, Germany's foreign minister, accused Boris Johnson of playing politics with peace in Northern Ireland. Annalena Baerbock, the German foreign minister, tweeted, "We as European Union have put concrete proposals for solutions on the table, with a firm view to citizens and businesses who benefit from the EU single market every day, and the preservation of the Good Friday Agreement. Peace and prosperity on the island of Ireland are not a pawn." Legal experts quickly cast doubt on the government's justification for flouting international law. David Anderson, a crossbench peer, barrister and visiting professor at King's College School of Law, said, "It sounds thin to me, not to say threadbare." While Emily Thornberry, the shadow Attorney General, said the argument was complete and utter nonsense. In its legal summary, the government said, "This is a genuinely exceptional situation, and it is only in the challenging, complex and unique circumstances of Northern Ireland that the government has reluctantly decided to introduce legislative measures which, on entry into force, envisage the non-performance of certain obligations. It is the government's position that, in light of the state of necessity, any such non-performance of its obligations contained in the withdrawal agreement and or the protocol as a result of the planned legislative measures would be justified as a matter of international law." It argued the peril in Northern Ireland was not inherent in the protocol's provisions. The legislation is likely to encounter serious opposition in the House of Commons and in the House of Lords, with doubts over whether Boris Johnson had support for it to pass. Ministers are also likely to come under some pressure for publication of the full legal advice on the move, as well as the impact assessment, which was not published alongside the bill. The legislation has some critics on the Eurosceptic right, as well as some on the One Nation centrist wing of the Tory party. Government sources said they hoped a vote on the bill would take place before Parliament breaks up for the summer recess, but ministers would want to see some progress towards power sharing returning in Northern Ireland first, which the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, has so far been blocking. Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, the DUP leader, did not signal whether his party would return to the Northern Ireland Assembly or give full support for the bill, but said, "The British government is right to act, and we look forward to giving full consideration to this legislation." A majority of members of the Northern Ireland Assembly, from Sinn Féin, the SDLP and the Alliance Party, wrote to Boris Johnson on Monday, saying they could not support the move because it flies in the face of the express wishes of not just most businesses, but most people in Northern Ireland. The Assembly is due to vote on whether it gives the consent for the operation of the protocol in 2024, 4 years after it came into force. With opposition mounting, there are some doubts among MPs and that the legislation will get anywhere. The government has insisted it would still rather find a negotiated solution to fix problems with the Northern Ireland protocol, but Ireland said on Monday that the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss had not engaged in negotiations with the protocol in a meaningful way since February. A phone call on Monday morning between Liz Truss and Simon Coveney, the Irish foreign minister, lasted just 12 minutes. A spokesperson for Ireland's Foreign Affairs Department said, Mr. Coveney said publishing legislation that would breach the UK's commitments under international law, the Brexit Withdrawal Agreement and Northern Ireland Protocol, is deeply damaging to relationships on these islands and between the United Kingdom and the European Union.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to talk about one of the most outstanding fuqaha and religious authorities of the Shiite world. He is no one but Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari, who is known by founding the Islamic Seminary of Hujjatiyah or Madrasa Hujjatiyah in the holy city of Qom. We will, of course, talk about this foundation and this school and this Islamic seminary in Qom. But before that, I'll be happy with Sheikh Ziyaniya giving us some information about the early life of Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari was born in the 29th day of Sha'ban, according to lunar calendar, in the year of 1310. His family are scholar family, and there are many scholars brought up in this family, amongst which is his father and also his two sons. And he was from Sadat, as his name is explaining it, Sayyid Muhammad. So his lineage goes back to Imam al-Sajjad, alayhi salam, the fourth Imam of Shia school of thought. And his father, Sayyid Ali, was born in Tabriz. And he moved to Najaf to study Islamic studies.
That's right.
And his father continued his Islamic studies up to the higher levels, and we may say that his father also was close to ijtihad.
That's right.
Or even we may say that his father also was a mujtahid.
Okay.
It's better. Yeah.
Okay. What about his teachers?
His teachers are amongst... of course, we should mention this point that Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat is not only, expert in a single field. Mm-hmm. He decided to study different fields of studies, amongst which is, for example, mathematics.
Okay, yes.
And also medicine.
Medicine, okay.
He completed his primary studies with his father, that was his teacher also. And then after that, beside being a student, started his teaching. That, this is a manner of most of the scholars in Islamic seminary.
That's right.
And then from Tabriz, he moved to Najaf at the year of 1330 to continue his Islamic studies in higher levels.
Mm-hmm.
And at that level, he studied fiqh, usul, hadith, and rijal with these teachers like Sheikh al-Sharia Isfahani, Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani, the great marja of Shia, Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri, Mirza Muhammad Hussein Na'ini, and Ziauddin Araghi, that all these figures are the great figures and great scholars in the galaxy of Shia.
Truly they are. Okay, Sheikh Mahdavi, what about his migration to the city of Qom and his stay up to the last moment of his life? He migrates to Qom, he founds a school over here. After his demise, even he's buried in his own school. Let's talk about these details of the life of Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Before we talk about his move to Qom, we have to say that he actually didn't want to come back to Iran. Oh. When he left Tabriz for the first time and he went to Najaf because of the bad situation, I mean the weather situation, he got sick and his father demanded him to go back to Iran. You cannot tolerate this situation. For a short period of time, he stayed in Tabriz. Again, he moved back to Najaf, but he realized that this condition he cannot tolerate. So he was forced to come back to Iran. This time he chose Qom to stay. Why? Because of actually the scholarly environment of the Qom. When he comes to Qom at that time, we have to acknowledge the role of Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi as a founder of the seminary school of Qom. Although he is a great, outstanding marja of that time, but this is also important that Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari didn't benefit as a student, but as a matter of respect, he would go to his classes, he would participate in his lessons. Mistakenly, some of the biographers have noted his name as the prominent student of Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi, while he was not the student, only as a matter of respect, as my brother mentioned. He was really, he has said that he has been refraining from fame. And this is one of the very important things. So by the time he moved back to Qom, he was at the level of ijtihad. He didn't actually need to participate anymore in these classes, which are prepared for the elementary students. By the way, as a matter of respect, he participated in the classes of the Sheikh Abdul Karim.
This is an akhlaqi point for all the scholars, you know.
Yes, definitely.
Even at very high ranks, they participated their, we can say, gathering and courses on different lessons of on Islamic studies. This shows the respect that they had for each other.
And that's why we see that he earned the respect and trust of Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi. And he recommended him to lead the Salat. And even after him, he delegated the leadership of the school to him and to other scholars. Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr and the other one. So he was really at the very high level of the knowledge and also akhlaq. And when we look at his life and the services that he bestowed and granted the students, we see from the great favors for the students at that time, we see this establishment of the school of Hujjatiyya. And many students or many people might be familiar with this name. Madrasatul Hujjatiyya.
Yes, most of the people might not know that this Hujjatiyya is named after Hujjat Qamari, okay?
Yes.
Even maybe some of the Persians or Iranians, even the students do not know that why this name is, can I say, put on the name of the school. There is a bridge, you know, to give geographical information, there is a bridge by the name of Hujjatiyya Bridge and then Hujjatiyya School. And today is the, you know, the gathering place for so many of the students, also the foreign students, spirit to say. The foreign students.
Today
the
it's only dedicated for the foreign students. It's
that's
not
right.
anymore for the Iranian ones.
The Tollab and the Islamic seminary students that come from outside Iran, you know, enroll over there and continue their Islamic studies over there. What was the main intention of establishing such a school? I mean, because there was Hawza, and when you take a look at the distance between Hujjatiyya school and the Faiziyya school, you know, what was the main intention of establishing such a school?
As you know, when late Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri moved to Qom, according to the invitations that was sent toward him, after this event, the numbers of tulab and clergymen in Qom was increasing. So this event made it necessary to establish more schools and Islamic seminary schools for students to reside and also participate in the classes and get benefit from teachers.
That's right.
And you know, this is really normal, and it's a norm in Islamic seminaries to build the accommodation beside the classes.
Yes.
So this school was also like the others in this regard. And so that's why he decided to establish such a school.
Mm-hmm.
And beside this, I should mention this story also. This is very important.
Very good.
That it is quoted that once late Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri wrote to Marhum Sayyid Hojjat Kamari that if you need something, we are at your service.
Mm-hmm.
And Abdul Karim is eager to assist you. And help you.
Okay.
And late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hojjat Kuh Kamari responded that, thank you very much. We are in need of Karim more than to Abdul Karim.
Oh.
So this is very important.
Karim referring to Allah subhanahu
yes,
wa ta'ala.
Because Karim is one of the names of Allah subhanahu
attributes
wa ta'ala.
Attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay.
Yeah. So,
so what a respectful answer it was.
Yes.
Okay.
He didn't reject the offer of late Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim.
Okay.
But he said that we all are in need of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Karim more than Abdul Karim. That's right.
So okay. The establishment of this school is one of the services that he did toward Islamic seminaries beside establishing a good library inside this school.
Okay. They say that Ayatollah Hojjat Kuh Kamari, one of his interests was protecting the Shi'ad legacy, including especially the manuscripts, you know, the books. And by establishing such a school, he was after doing so. But the akhlaq of the late Sayyid Muhammad Kuh Kamari also attracted so many people, especially the students, the akhlaqi courses that he had on his marja'iyya and his qom. And he was really a true reviver. Beside the other ulama, we can say I have the names over here, the other maraja, like for example Sayyid Muhammad Taghi Khansari and Sayyid Saduddin Asad, as the custodians of the Islamic Hawza of Qom. Because you know, when Ayatollah Abdul Karim Hariri has founded this school, he needed some people like deputies or assistants. So he, along the other, we can say ulama, were in charge of taking care of the affairs. And they say that this Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hojjat Kuh Kamari was really, we can say, interested in taking, we can say, the responsibility of taking care of the financial affairs of the students, of the houses, the payments, the monthly payments that are given, you know, out of the Hawza funds to the students of the Tullab on that time. Really great achievements by him.
Something we should take in serious consideration here is that he was really eager to help and assist Islamic seminaries,
yes,
even during the life of Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri, yes, and even after the demise of Sheikh Abdul Karim. But when Sheikh Abdul Karim Rahmatullah Alayhi appoints him beside the two different figures,
yes,
I mean Sayyid Sadruddin Sadr and Sayyid Muhammad Khansari.
Muhammad Taghi Khansari, yes.
Sayyid Muhammad Taghi Khansari, they, according to the courtesy that they had, they decided to announce another figure as the leader of Islamic seminary of Qom. And this is very important because they were at they were at the position of getting the highest level in the Islamic seminary, and maybe many figures, maybe many people, they are eager to achieve such position, but they refrained this position and passed it toward late Ayatollah Sayyid Hossein Burujerdi. This is another important aspect of his life to escape fame, although many of us maybe would be eager to follow this issue.
Okay. Thank you very much. Sheikh Mahat, have you any missing point about the life of Sayyid Muhammad?
Maybe for his last moments of his life, it is narrated that his daughter gave him actually some soil of Karbala to take
the turba.
Blessed
turba of Karbala,
Imam Hussein alayhi salam, to take it as a cure or healing
for the remedy.
Before he takes that, he is deciding to break his ring because he was not sure that he is going to stay in this this world anymore. And this is one of the custom of the maraja,
yes,
that they will break the ring, which will be used as the seal for all of
for
their
the letters
and everything.
Or documents.
So he wanted to break this ring, okay. And he was given the turba of Imam Hussein, okay. And he was not sure that this turba is going to cure him or not.
Okay.
So he take the khira from the Quran to see what Allah will say, and this verse will come, lahu da'watul haq. So he will actually make sure that this is the last moment of his life, and this turba is not supposed to cure him, but as a matter of respect, he is saying that wa akhiru zadi min ad-dunya at-turba, meaning that okay, I'm not going to stay anymore, and he breaks the ring,
the ring.
This actually story has been written on the tomb of his grave as well.
Okay, that's all right. So breaking the ring as a sign of showing that I'm not in authority anymore.
Yeah.
Okay.
The letters and the vocala and all monies and homes and everything that would be collected under his name will not be...
So I'm free. I'm absolutely free. I'm not in doubt to anybody or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah. This is a custom of the Maharaja. Sometimes after their death.
Death, that's right.
Yes. The followers of the sons, they will take it.
Okay. But finally, he took the turba.
Yeah. Akhiru zadi.
Okay.
He recites this actually part that Akhiru zadi min ad-dunya turbatul Hussein.
MashaAllah.
The last sustenance.
That's right. The last sustenance or the last thing to take is the turba of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. That's all right. Really, many lessons we can take from the life of these outstanding men, you know, the religious men, including Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Kukamiri, the founder and the establisher of Hujjatiyah School, which is the... we can say a welcoming place for so many students, especially the foreign students who are interested in continuing their Islamic studies in Islamic Republic of Iran, the holy city of Qom. Jamadi al-Awwal 1372, according to the Hijri lunar calendar, is the day that he passed away in the holy city of Qom, and his body was taken into a chamber very close to the mosque of the Hujjatiyah Madrasa or the Islamic Seminary in the city of Qom. He is buried over there, the visiting place and the tomb of so many scholars and students nowadays. That's all right. May Allah bless the soul of Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Kukamari. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyania.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi for your presence in the program, The Teacher. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information and to download for free our other episodes of the program, The Teacher, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Islam page. To another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.